welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This is ABC Radio National with a science show just 32 years old. But that's nothing. Which science program has been going for 50 years, presented by the same chap every month, except one, when he ate a bad goose egg?
This is a very unusual and a very special Sky at Night.
Recognise that voice? Hello, I'm Robin Williams. The 50th anniversary of the longest-running science show in the known universe was on Tuesday. All will be revealed later. The revelations about dragon lizards came in the current edition of the journal Science. They have sex chromosomes, but nonetheless are affected by temperature. I caught up with the author, Professor Jenny Graves, at a posh hotel in Melbourne.
This is the western dragon that's up in the west of Queensland and New South Wales. It's a beautiful species and people in America particularly use it as pets.
And what have you done with it?
We've been looking at sex determination in this dragon for years. We're particularly interested in it because one species does sex by temperature. That is, if it's hot, they're all girls, and if it's cold, they're all boys. Another species does it by genetics. That is, it's 50% boys and girls, whatever the temperature. And we were fascinated to know what the difference was and how we could get at the genes that are controlling sex by temperature and sex by chromosomes.
By the way, why is this an advantage to be able to determine your sex from the temperature? How did it, do you think, come to be like that?
The best stories I've heard about the American alligators, the story is that if it's hot, you're a boy, and if it's cold, you're a girl. The females prefer to lay their eggs down near the water where it's cool, and these are female-producing nests. So if there aren't too many alligators around, most of the young are going to hatch into females, which is, of course, a very good way of building up the population quickly. If there's an awful lot of alligators around, some poor females have to make their nests up in the hot tops of the levees, and they're male-producing nests. So you get a lot of males, and they fight, and the best man wins.
OK, so you investigate the dragon. What do you find?
Well, this was a big surprise. Our role in this is looking at genes and chromosomes, and our colleagues at the University of Canberra are doing molecular ecology. So we discovered, to our great surprise a couple of years ago, that this genetic species has perfectly good sex chromosomes, just like humans or just like chickens, which we didn't expect. We thought it'd be a very recent system and then only be a gene or two different. But there's a whole sex chromosome that looks very, very ancient. And so we certainly didn't expect it ever to vary from having 50% boys and 50% girls. But our colleagues at the University of Canberra took the temperatures up further and further, and when it's hot, they're all girls. So sex chromosomes or no, the sex is actually reversed, and we have a molecular marker that can tell us what the chromosomes are, so we can demonstrate directly that some of the females produced were supposed to be genetically males.
Are these the sort of creatures who, if there are no men around, can actually reproduce? There is a sort of parthenogenetic means of doing it, or are they kind of marooned?
This particular species, there's never been any parthenogenesis reported, but of course there's been recent reports of the Komodo dragon that if there are no males around, the females can do it themselves, so I wouldn't put anything past them.
I was just thinking of global warming, because if it gets hotter and hotter and hotter, this is obviously going to have some effect, isn't it?
People have been very concerned about temperature-sensitive sex species like crocodiles and turtles, because if the world gets hotter, we're going to have nothing but male alligators. But of course, people thought that all the reptiles that have sex chromosomes were safe and it wouldn't matter what temperature it was. We think now that that's probably not true. And we think that, in fact, the two systems are really variants of the same system. And that means we should be a lot more concerned about reptiles in general.
Back to the lizards. What do you think the news that you've published in the journal Science is going to do to the discussion amongst your fellow scientists about this phenomenon? Will it surprise them?
I think people will be very surprised. People have been very interested in sex determination in lizards for about 30 or 40 years. And, of course, it would be a big coup to be able to figure out how it happens. What we're proposing is that there is a particular gene on the sex chromosomes that makes a protein, and you need a particular amount of that protein to be male. And that means that if there's one copy in females, they can never be male. But this protein we are proposing is unstable at a hot temperature, so it breaks down. So we're really saying that the temperature and the genetic sex are the same thing. It's the same gene that's controlling them, and we actually know where to look for this gene.
And about my own Y chromosome, you're famous for saying that it's kind of the remains of junk DNA and on the way out. Is that really, should I worry?
Well, not unless you're planning on being around 10 million years hence, because I've calculated by the rate of loss of genes, it's going to be about another 10 million years before the Y runs out of genes. And I think the world may well have run out of people long before then.
Professor Jenny Graves of the Australian National University in Canberra with Hope for the Y. Her paper is in the journal Science. Lynn Beasley of Perth is also fond of dragons. She teaches blind ones to see again and to catch their dinner. What's more, she's just become the chief scientist of Western Australia. So, will she still go to the lab?
Very much so. I have a terrific team, and I must say I get up very early in the morning now, but for me that's important. In this new position, I think I have to be seen by the scientific community as still there, contributing. And I'm a data junkie. I couldn't leave the lab. So for me, it's just a wonderful combination. But as I visit other laboratories, I increasingly realise as chief scientist that I'm not taking advantage of all the expertise in the state and beyond, and nor is anyone else. And one of my jobs is really, somebody said to join up the dots. I actually have to dig to find the dots, and then I join them up.
The work we left last time I talked to you was about the lizard, the dragon, which had one eye affected by surgery, so it couldn't see, and the other eye was working quite well. But when you did the experiment to see if you could join it up using chemicals, you found that the eye that had been treated could begin to see and connect properly only if it was kind of active. Would you describe that and what happened next?
Yes, it was an amazing procedure. In fact, if you're working with something like a rat, and this would apply to humans too, we actually have to put agents and molecules into the eye to stimulate the nerves to regrow. And they don't regrow very far yet, but we're off and running on that. But the lizard can do it for you. It can actually regrow nerves back from the eye to the brain. It finds the right part of the brain, the visual part, as opposed to, say, the hearing or the part concerned with smell. The problem is it can't find the exact address in it. So it's like getting to the right suburb but not finding the right street or the right house. And therefore you end up with a very mixed up vision, which must be like for the lizard, looking at the world as if the jigsaw pieces had been moved around. In fact, we found as they were regrowing their nerves, they would often keep the eyelids of that eye shut, and we now know why, because the input must have been so confusing, it was better not to see it at all and just use the other eye that we hadn't in any way influenced. But we found that during the time the nerves regrew, if we gave stimulation only 2 half-hours a week, but of something the lizard really liked, which was usually a juicy mealworm on the end of a stick, then it would start to see again. In the end, it could move its pupil, it could follow the stimulus, and boy, you've seen the videos, it could leap and catch accurately. It had restored vision.
Any chance that you could use the same system with mammals?
I think it's going to be essential. What's becoming very clear, and let's move across to the spinal cord literature now. After injury to the spinal cord, we're beginning to learn that just one chemical, for example, might help nerves to regrow, but won't be enough. We might end up with a combination of stem cells and agents to induce recovery, such as growth factors. But unless we stimulate that system to get the nerve fibres to actively connect up with the right partner, the outcome will be less good. So you're going to see rats, as they recover, being put into training wheels where they can actually, as they obviously enjoy doing, run around and get more activity. And a very good example, actually, was a study with rats that in which there was a partial injury to the spinal cord. And if you put the water bottle just down near it, so they could just go ahead and drink whenever they liked, the recovery wasn't spectacular. But if you put the water bottle further up, so they had to stretch up on tippy toe to get it, then you had a better outcome. So we say it's probably going to be a combination of cells and molecules, but please don't forget the training. It's going to be a key part as well.
Well, a key part, of course, is your sticking to the lab with this exciting work. Just an update on the work that we've covered over the years, with more and more progress in reconnecting the central nervous system, which is extraordinary. Back to Chief Scientist, what are going to be your priorities?
Okay, my philosophy is to build on our strengths, use the wonderful scientists we have here, but also import those and certainly bring back Australians if we can. I then want to translate more of that science, be it for the minerals industry, for agriculture, for health, for fisheries, you name it, whichever system it is can benefit from the research that's being done here in the state. And the third thing is to communicate it, because everyone must share in the vision of science being important in Western Australia's future. So I want to particularly target the years 3 to 5s, and I'm looking at innovative programs to get to those. With a granddaughter who knows every dinosaur that is, I'd like to share that sort of enthusiasm with others. And also particularly the years 9 to 12s at school, the 14s to 16s and 17-year-olds who are trying to decide whether to do science and at the moment attending not to do it in enough numbers. And I'm actually visiting schools to talk to year 10s and talk to them about science and how exciting it is, what a great career you can have, how rewarding, how you can travel the world. And the way I've put it is that we need doctors and nurses, there's no doubt, but the planet is sick. We need doctors and nurses to the planet, and that will be mathematicians to analyse all the data on climate change, scientists to look for solutions, and engineers to put that into practice.
Well, you're not a chief ornithologist, because just now your coffee's sitting over there. We're sitting outside the University of Western Australia, lovely sunshine, and your coffee has just been delivered with a biscuit. And while you were talking, a seagull came up to your cup and removed the biscuit and flew off with it, going chomp. But you mentioned dinosaurs just now. One of the things that worries me, being an observer in various states, I think New South Wales is really sometimes the most pathetic, being supposedly a rich state and the funding of science has really collapsed. But here in Western Australia, we had John Long on the other day, vertebrate... Of course, you know, knows about dinosaurs. When he left, there was practically no employed vertebrate paleontologist in the whole state.
Absolutely. The person we share, of course, is Dr. Gavin Prideaux, who is a very brilliant young scientist. He's based jointly between the museum in Western Australia and Flinders University. So you're right, we need to invest in people such as Gavin to ensure, for example, all his wonderful discoveries about the fossils under the Nullarbor Plain inform us about climate change. So really we need a strong science base. One terrific program that Western Australia has put in place are the Premier's Fellows. These are 6 excellent scientists, and certainly I can see that such a scheme could really benefit not only Western Australia by being expanded, but adopted by other states, in which we retain the best of our people, but we brain gain by bringing people from overseas. And in fact, I'll be visiting Britain soon, and when I'm there, I'm going to make sure I meet up with all the Rhodes Scholars, because they're certainly amongst the best of our Australians, and they're over there, and I don't want them to stay there.
You want to bring them back, obviously. A final point, just to harp on that investment. Enormous amounts of money coming from resources, mining, of course, in Western Australia. Are you going to persuade the government to put more into science than they have been so far?
Well, I see myself as an advocate for science, a facilitator and an advisor to government. And clearly you need funds to carry out these programs, but you need good organisations, good ways of bringing people together. And that's, I think, the other thing I can do to optimise the funds we have available. But we have to look to beyond the boom. We have a boom in Australia, Western Australia in particular. It will probably be extended as a result of science. Discovering new ore bodies, for example, will extend the boom for us. But after that, we have to be so super smart that we can inform the rest of the world on the best way to do things. And that's going to be a science-based initiative.
Well, good luck with that and good luck with the brains.
Thank you so much.
Professor Lynn Beasley is the new chief scientist of Western Australia, and she's now on her way to Britain to repatriate our Rhodes Scholars, or try. And this is The Science Show on ABC Radio National via your PC and oral device. And this week, as no doubt you saw in the papers, we have a new planet, one that Goldilocks could live with. Jonathan Nally.
Astronomers have now detected almost 230 planets circling other stars in our galaxy, the Milky Way. Most of them are very large, many times the mass of Jupiter, and most have orbits that are either too near or too far from their parent star to fall within what scientists call the Goldilocks zone, a narrow orbital region around a star where the temperature is just right for liquid water to exist. They've either been too big, too hot, or too cold. That's the story so far. But just a few days ago, European astronomers announced the detection of a planet that's not only roughly the same size as Earth, it's smack bang in the middle of its star's Goldilocks zone too. The star is called Gliese 581, a red dwarf, a small, cool star about 20 light years from Earth, right in our own backyard, astronomically speaking. The planet is estimated to be about 5 times the mass of Earth, which, they calculate, would give it about 1.5 times Earth's diameter. It's also 14 times closer to its star than Earth is to the Sun. But because the red dwarf is much cooler than the Sun, the planet shouldn't get fried. In fact, the discoverers estimate that its average surface temperature is probably somewhere between 0 and 40 degrees. Their models suggest it would either have a rocky surface or one covered with oceans of liquid water. Although a few other planets not much bigger than this one have been found circling other stars, none of them are in their star's habitable zones. Gliese 581 itself was already well known to planet hunters. The same team had already found a Neptune-sized planet there, and they have other data that suggests there's probably a third planet, about 8 times the mass of Earth. Almost all of the planets known outside our solar system are too far away to be detected directly. Rather, the astronomers study the stars they belong to. Just as a star holds its planets in orbit with its gravity, so too do its planets exert a slight gravitational pull on the star, making it wobble ever so slightly in place. Amazingly, given the distances involved, this wobbling can be measured, even though it's only a few meters per second. And by gathering data over a long period, the presence of planets can be deduced from the pattern of the wobbles. This is called the radial velocity technique. Red dwarfs are the most common stars in the galaxy. 80 of the 100 closest stars to Earth are red dwarfs. And because they're cooler, their habitable zone is much closer in, which actually makes it easier to detect any planets that might be there using the radial velocity method. So there we have it, a planet that could be similar to Earth and not that far away. Space telescope systems are on the drawing board that might one day be able to directly image this planet and analyse its atmosphere for signs of life. And then we'll really know whether we've hit gold in the Goldilocks zone.
And Jonathan Nally hits gold in next week's Science Show with an extended celebration of that spectacular supernova found 20 years ago. And so to the longest-running TV science programme presented by one chap. Any idea?
This is a very unusual and a very special Sky at Night. It's our 50th anniversary, and we're going to indulge in a little time travel and go back to 1957 and the first programme, and then on to 2057 and meet Dr. Brian May on the surface of Mars. Well, I've been on the air now for half a century, and I've presented every programme except one when I was laid low by that Richard Goose Egg.
He eats goose eggs, wears a monocle, and does time travel. To get a glimpse of this extraordinary man, let's do some time travel of our own and revisit a science show in 1978. Hold tight.
Hello, Patrick Moore is the world's best-known amateur astronomer. His programme, The Sky at Night, has run for 21 unbroken years on British television. He's the author of countless books about the moon and the solar system. He's also said to be Britain's fastest talker. I went to see Patrick Moore at his cottage near the sea at Selsey in Sussex. The garden is full of telescopes, and the house itself crammed with star maps and books on space. I was also intrigued to see xylophones everywhere. Mr. Moore is a keen musician. In one corner was a pile of pads and flannels and other cricket gear. He's a vigorous exponent of an unusual brand of leg spin, and told me he's enjoyed many a good day's cricket with Tony Gregg and other famous Sussex players. Quite a feat for such an enormous man. I was also surprised to see Patrick Moore dressed so formally in a blue suit, yet sporting a large Texas cowboy choker round his neck. And it was interesting to hear him claim to be the most right-wing Englishman alive. Anyway, I'd made the appointment to find out what Patrick Moore thought about the achievements of space research since the men first landed on the moon. This is what he had to say.
I remember the time, and it's not so very long ago, when the moon was generally regarded by professional astronomers as rather dull and parochial when nothing ever happened. And therefore mapping the moon was left very largely to the amateurs, of which I was one, and we did produce the original moon maps, and of course they were useful at the time, even though they've been completely superseded now. But cast your mind back only to the early 1960s. There was a theory, widely popularised, that the moon's maria, that's to say the dried-up seas, if you can call them seas, were in fact nothing but beds of soft dust. And one very eminent authority stated quite categorically that any spacecraft landing there would simply sink out of sight with all its gear. And as I've always said, after a journey of 250,000 miles through space, that would be rather disappointing. And I think that illustrates how little we did then know about the moon.
Patrick, you prefer to be called an amateur. Did you ever feel that the time of the amateur had passed, or that you'd have no particular function as someone contributing to the discoveries in later times?
No, not a bit. I was engaged in my early days, right back from the age when I was about 11, in mapping the moon. And, of course, these maps did turn out to be useful. And actually, when the Russians sent their first unmanned probe round the moon way back in 1959, that was Luna 3, they used my charts to tie up the far side photographs with the pictures of the side of the moon we can always see. But Luna cartography is now completed. But on the moon, we are still tracking down these elusive transients, and it's left for the amateur to do that. So far as the planetary surfaces are concerned, well, we're doing the same kind of thing. There's a lot of work to be done on Jupiter, for example. But even going further afield, the amateur makes himself very useful in things such as comet hunting. There's one great amateur, George Alcock, who lives over in Peterborough, as a schoolmaster, and he's discovered several comets and also several novae. And of course you have Mr. Bradfield in Australia, who's one of the most famous comet hunters in the world. He's an amateur, and he does outstanding work, work that the professional can't really do. Then, of course, we have exploding stars, or novae, and these also are hunted for and observed and very often discovered by amateurs. Oh, there are all kinds of facets to it. What I would say is that the work of the amateur astronomer is still warmly welcomed by the professional. It is as important as it has ever been, probably more so, and it's limitless, but the great difference is that your amateur of 1978 has to be more specialised than he used to be in the days when I took it up in the early 1930s. That's the main difference.
Maybe it's not a fair question, but say the shuttle works extremely well, and by the turn of the century, with luck, you'll be hale and healthy. Would you like to go and travel in the planets?
I would love to go, and I'm under no delusions that I will. You say by the turn of the century. My dear chap, I am now 55 years old. In 10 years, I shall be 65, and I think that's about the time when non-specialists can be expected to go up in shuttles. So I'm afraid, and I personally am going to miss it. I'm not too despondent. Much though I'd love to go, much though I'd love to go to the moon, I have at least had the fun of being involved in the very early stages, even in my own humble capacity as a mere observer, and that's enough for me, really.
And now in 2007, he's 84. So what did he do for his 50th anniversary programme? Why, he interviewed himself. One self in 1957, the other in 2007.
Hello, Patrick. Sorry to interrupt you.
I say hello. Who is that distinguished fellow? By Jove, it's me.
Yes, it's good to see you after all these years. I thought I'd come and wish you luck for the very first Sky at Night programme. Well, we're recording the 50th anniversary of Sky at Night in 2007. We thought you might like to join in.
Goodness gracious, 50 years. Quite wonderful. I only asked for 3 programmes and they haven't even given me a contract.
And you won't get one either.
Really? Well, I must say they've given us a very good write-up in the Radio Times, but a dreadfully late time slot, 10:30 in the evening. I do hope it won't go out much later than that.
Make the most of it. Things won't get any better there, I'm afraid.
But 50 years on, Patrick, surely you must remember all of this for yourself.
Not really. One forgets how much has changed. I mean, technology, for example.
Indeed. Evidently, we've invented some kind of time travel. And I always was a little sceptical about that. But we are making great strides in technology here in 1957. The Americans have the giant 200-inch optical telescope in Palomar, California. But in Britain, we're completing the world's largest fully steerable radio telescope at Jodrell Bank in Cheshire. Hugely exciting, but I fear rather expensive. The costs have spiralled to an amazing £700,000.
It may sound a lot to you in 1957, but it doesn't sound much today. Inflation had become really astronomical.
Stand by, studio. 1 minute to go.
Look, I'd very much like to talk about the future, but not at present. No time. We're on air in just 1 minute, and we're still undecided about the music.
What are your thoughts?
Well, he's been talking about using You Are My Lucky Star, but I rather prefer something more cheerful. What we need is a bit of stark Scandinavian introspection in a minor key, like Sibelius at the castle gate.
Go for the Sibelius. You won't be sorry.
Really? Well, with the foresight of hindsight, I'm sure time will bear that one out. Tell the producer I wish to use the Sibelius. In fact, I insist.
One last thing, Patrick. Avoid that wretched goose egg. In 2004, it darn near killed me.
3.
Look, I'm sorry, Patrick. I didn't quite catch that. Was it important?
Hugh Grant.
Here we go.
Never mind. Good luck.
Good evening. What I want to do in these talks is tell you about some of the interesting things you can see in the night sky each month.
And then they whipped forward to 2057 to discover the lead guitarist of Queen, Brian May, nicely settled on Mars.
Also on Mars is another old friend of the sky at night, Dr. Brian May. He's at the European Mars base in Gusev Crater, where the Spirit probe landed so long ago. And Chris went there to see him.
Well, Brian, welcome back to the sky at night.
Thank you very much, Chris.
You've been on Mars now for, what, a year? What brought you here in the first place?
Well, have a seat, Chris. It's because the astronomy is so great here. There's no atmosphere to speak of, there's no clouds, absolutely no light pollution, of course. Perfect. I've been studying interplanetary dust, as you probably know, which was the subject of my thesis in, 2007. Look at the dust on that.
Yes, well, even in the middle of nowhere, though, Brian, you've done a lot to make home out of your life habitat.
Yes, well, I think it's a good idea. I think the most important thing I brought out here is my little old reflecting telescope, which me and my dad made when I was a boy. I've had some great fun looking at the Martian night sky with that. And I also have Patrick's old 1879 Mars globe.
Yes, he rescued that from a skip in Oxford, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, beautiful. Good job, eh?
Hello, Patrick Moore here.
Robin Williams here in Sydney.
Hello, Robin.
Congratulations. 50
Thank
years.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely wonderful. How was the party?
Almost every important astronomer in the country was there, I think. Very few people couldn't come, so it was a real galaxy of astronomers.
Excellent. And you've been doing the programme now for 50 years.
50 years. I did the first one on the 24th of April, 1957, and we haven't missed a month since.
What did you do on that first programme? Can you remember?
I do indeed. We were greeted by a comet. Comet Allen-Raymond, the brightest for some time. A bright naked eye comet, and that ushered us in. And also we had an eclipse of the moon, so we had two things to bring us into our first programme.
Patrick Moore, I remember when you saw for the first time, live on air, the backside of the moon, and I remember you so well. Bursting into tears.
I remember that so well, because as you know, there's part of the moon that's always turned away from us, and which therefore we can never see. But I've been mapping the edges of the moon by the foreshortened, and the Russians had sent over for my maps. And when they got the first pictures back from the far side by their circumlunar probe, Lunik 3, they said they'd send them through to me, and they actually came through on my screen when I was on the air doing a Sky at Night program. And I remember the voice of the producer in my ears, first pictures from the moon's far side, coming over in 10 seconds, scrap what we planned, do it off the cuff, good luck. And up came the first picture.
And I remember you crying. How did you feel?
I didn't actually cry. But,
yes, you did.
I forget what I said, because the BBC have lost all the tapes. But I certainly, I had a bit of luck. But on that picture, the first, the other side of the moon, there are a tiny bit of the side we can see, and there was one feature I recognised, the Mare Crisium or Sea of Crises. And it gave me my bearings. I was able to give a commentary.
How long will you continue to do it, do you think?
It depends. Depends on how long I feel I can, how long people want me to, how long the BBC wants me to. And I say, as far as I feel I'm equal to it. The first bad programme I do that's my fault will also be my last. But I hope it hasn't happened yet.
Yes. Finally, how do you feel about the news that's come out this week of the new planet that looks very much like Earth?
Interesting. I'm not in the least surprised. 100,000 million stars in our galaxy. Many of these have planets. There must be millions of planets like this. We haven't so far found them, but this is interesting. It's fairly near, a mere 20 light years. But remember, if we sent a signal to it, it wouldn't get there for 20 years.
Well, congratulations again. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
Thank you so much.
And enjoy the rest of the parties.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to talk to you. That was a live broadcast to Australia.
They don't make them like that anymore, do they? He's now Sir Patrick. Patrick Moore, aged 84, celebrating the 50th anniversary of The Sky at Night this week.
1957 seems a long time ago. Over the past 50 years, all of us in The Sky at Night have done our best to bring the sky to everybody. I hope we succeeded, and we'll go on doing that as long as we can. But what's going to happen during the next 50 years? Frankly, we just don't know. Good night.
In all our discussions of energy technologies, you may have seen Four Corners last week, little has been said about wave power. Does it rate? Naomi Fowler reports from Scotland.
What you can hear is the huge, bright orange Palamis or Sea Snake wave energy capture device being towed out to sea. It looks like four carriages of a locomotive train without the windows floating on the sea surface. This is what the excitement's all about. This is the new technology that will be providing electricity for Scottish homes on the world's largest commercial wave farm in Orkney.
In the past, many people had approached it from a sort of academic perspective of trying to design something which mathematically might capture 100% of the energy in a metre width of wave. But that's actually the wrong place to start.
Max Karkus of Ocean Power Delivery explains how their Palamis wave machine works.
The most important thing for a wave energy converter is to be survivable with the conditions that are out there at sea. You can have average wave conditions being there, you know, 99% of the time, but 1% of the year you get extreme waves, storm waves. As a concept, really what you want to be able to do is capture the average energy that's there most of the time whilst being almost invisible to the very large forces that are contained in storm waves. And that's really the reason our machine looks the way it does. It presents a minimal cross-sectional area pointing into the waves, which gives it excellent load-shedding capability in those extreme waves, whilst being very closely coupled to the average energy, the buoyancy versus weight forces that are there for most of the year. What happens is the machine is moored at its nose, and it self-references it. It will automatically point into the predominant swell. And then what happens is the waves travel down the length of this machine. So if you can imagine each of these train carriages moving both up and down and side to side, that occurs around hinged joints. And that movement's resisted by hydraulic rams, which you can think of a little bit like big bicycle pumps, which pump high-pressure hydraulic fluid through hydraulic motors, which turn generators. And that's essentially how the machine works.
Estimates on the untapped potential of wave power are pretty exciting. Each metre of Scottish coastline is believed to have enough wave energy reaching it to power 100 homes. If less than 0.1% of the total energy contained within the world's oceans and seas was harnessed, it could supply the planet's entire energy needs, exceeding the world's demand for electrical power by a factor of 5. Not only that, the World Energy Council reckons globally wave energy is a €730 billion market. It ticks all the boxes in terms of energy security, price stability, thousands of jobs, and of course it's key in tackling climate change.
If you wanted to invest in renewables in Scotland, Scotland appears to be getting its act together and perhaps would be a good place to do business.
Jason Ormiston of the Scottish Renewables Forum.
On the flip side, there are barriers to the development of that potential. There needs to be investment in the planning systems so that they work more efficiently. There needs to be greater consistency in decision making. There needs to be determinations quicker. If we really want to tap the potential, we need to be giving a long-term market signal, and that comes through the planning system. If they don't get that right, then the renewables project in Scotland will stall.
To a remote moor they came, small in number, but determined in their opposition. These protesters want a rethink on plans to route electricity pylons through this remote hillside.
It's simply desecration as far as we're concerned, and it sort of smacks of the usual thing. It's the cheapest and easiest way to do it. What does it matter about...
I might have to look to leaving, and this is just almost too much to bear.
Well, we're dreading it. We've been feeling this for a few years now. It's going to be horrendous.
Problem is, wild and windy places are often remote areas of outstanding natural beauty. Pylons need to be built or existing routes enlarged to carry the electricity produced by these renewable energy projects hundreds of miles to the towns and cities that can use it. There are protests, legal battles and public inquiries that can take years. Member of the Scottish Parliament Christine May believes now's the time for politicians to get tough.
If we are to be really serious about developing our capacity for marine energy, then we have to look at strengthening the grid. And that may mean some unpleasant decisions for people living in some of the more remote areas. I do think it's essential for us as politicians to have the courage of our convictions in the way that the post-war expansion of the electricity grid was dealt with, by government identifying it as a national necessity and taking the powers to make sure that that was dealt with and provided, because it is essential in order to meet our environmental targets.
Scotland hasn't just thrown cash at marine power projects, it's also legislated. This month, the marine supply obligation will force energy companies to provide a percentage of their electricity from wave or tidal power. Scottish members of Parliament really are keen to keep this youthful wave power industry in Scotland, and not to miss the boat again, as many feel they did with wind power, now well established in other European countries that some think were more far-sighted. Max Carcass again of Ocean Power Delivery.
Where we are is kind of where wind was 25, 30 years ago. The global market for wind turbines is worth about €15 billion per annum and employs many tens of thousands of people in the manufacture of wind turbines. And certain countries took the lead to establish markets for this technology, countries such as Denmark, Germany and Spain. And indeed, those are the countries that are really reaping the rewards today in terms of jobs, exports and industry. The global potential for wave energy, estimated by the World Energy Council, is an electricity generation market of about 2,000 terawatt hours per annum. To put that in relative terms, is broadly equivalent to the existing nuclear or hydroelectricity markets. Now, if that displaces conventional generation, that's potentially 1.5 to 2 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide per annum, which dwarfs many, many times over our individual countries' renewables targets. So it's a big environmental prize in moving forward on this as well.
Moving forward, Scotland certainly is. And what happens here in terms of development could help address not just the UK's carbon emissions, but the world's, if they can reconcile local rights and concerns with national needs. This is Naomi Fowler in Edinburgh, Scotland, for The Science Show.
Now, did you see the documentary on ABC television a couple of weeks ago about heart transplants, about how the recipients can receive the personality and even talents of the donor in the process? It came from what we call the total bollocks school of science journalism. Think about the heart, cut off from a nervous supply. How would it transmit to the donor's nervous system? Anyway, a more impressive approach to the complexities of the working heart is on Andrew McCulloch's computer screen at the University of California, San Diego. He's a New Zealander and engineer building an incredibly sophisticated picture of cardiac function.
That's right. It's a computer model that we reconstructed from tens of thousands of measurements under the microscope from a rabbit heart. We've done similar things with the mouse heart, and other groups have done these sort of reconstructions using other systems, including the human heart.
So you're looking at the heart as a pump, and you're also looking at its materials. You're designing the fibers as to which way they go. What is the actual aim of putting together something which is quite so simulated in terms of engineering of a piece of, well, meat anatomy?
Well, I think the first aim is understanding. So understanding how these complex and beautiful biological structures give rise to the remarkably efficient and reliable mechanical function that our hearts perform. And secondly, being able to use those models to understand what goes wrong in disease and how therapies like drugs or devices could be used to restore function and improve life.
Well, I would have thought that by now they'd have had it worked out. Aren't we approaching an anniversary of Harvey and Padua of several hundred years since the circulation was worked out? Are we still looking for various things that are unknown in this area?
Well, absolutely. I mean, heart failure is an incurable disease at the moment. The only treatment that is reliable is heart transplantation, but there are far, far fewer hearts available for transplantation and donors than there are the millions of patients in the United States alone that are suffering from heart failure.
On the screen, you've got your model. It looks like a beautiful purple heart. It's got various blue and white streaks on it, indicating what?
The patterns are the orientations of the muscle fibers at different layers through the thickness of the walls of the pumping chambers of the heart, the left and the right ventricle. And the muscle fibers form a sort of a spiral arrangement, and the orientation of the spiral changes continuously and smoothly and beautifully as you go through the heart wall. And in fact, all the way back to Harvey, the developmental origin of these beautiful structures and its physiological and mechanical significance have been the object of a lot of inquiry. And in fact, what the computational models have shown quite definitively is that these orientations that are remarkably similar in the rabbit and the mouse and human are really optimal for ensuring that every part of the heart wall of the normal heart does an equal amount of work. So it's carefully optimized so that no part of the wall is doing more work than all the neighbors and no part is doing less, because if so, then energy is being wasted.
Towards the end of last year on the Science Show, Dennis Noble, who I think you know, talked about the heart in terms of looking for sort of mission control. If I'm looking at the heart now and I'm seeing all these various fibers which are regularly, several times a minute, all through the day and for decades on end, beating in a particular way, looking for mission control. Now, Dennis Noble said there isn't a mission control. It's when the heart fibers are put together, the whole thing starts working as a piece. Now, that's in many ways quite surprising. Have you approached that mystery as an engineer as well?
Absolutely. So Dennis is completely right. There isn't a mission control. There isn't a gene for heart pumping. There isn't a gene for the failure of the heart to pump. These are complex functions that are the interaction of many different coordinated components. And what Dennis really pioneered was the use of mathematics to put those components together piece by piece. And the first mathematical model of a heart cell that he published in 1960 had exactly two components in it. And now the models have tens of thousands of components, including hundreds of cellular and molecular components, and then, of course, the thousands of structural components that you see in the slide.
I can see why you need an engineer to get this right, but what are you bringing to the medics, to the people who are treating these failures that you mentioned, in terms of a way forward?
Well, one of the applications that we've been working on recently and are actually beginning a clinical study on is a treatment for heart failure called cardiac resynchronization therapy, because doctors noticed that the failing weakly contracting heart was also asynchronously contracting because its electrical stimulation and conduction pattern was not synchronous and as fast as it should be, and that by using an external pacemaker, which normally make the sequence less synchronous, will make the failing heart more synchronous, and that improvement in electrical synchrony improves mechanical synchrony, and the improvement in mechanical synchrony improves mechanical performance, and thus can add quality of life and years of life to the heart failure patient. And so the problem is that trying to predict where those pacing electrodes should be used, which patients would benefit from them and which don't, is a complex question that brings in to bear all of the things we've been talking about. And the models are now being used to predict, surprisingly reliably, what will work and what won't, how the use of the cardiac resynchronization therapy will improve the function of the failing heart.
As you said, it's a huge problem. Vast numbers of people suffering, and some of them dying of these effects. What sort of impact do you think this new sophisticated way of looking at it could make?
Well, it costs now $1 billion to bring a drug to market in the United States after all the FDA approvals. A lot of heart drugs, it turns out, are particularly difficult to develop because of some well-publicized failures in which drugs that were designed to reduce the incidence of sudden cardiac death actually increased it. And so I think that the use of models that synthesize a large amount of experimental, biological, structural, and clinical data will help to streamline that process, reduce the failure rate, reduce the costs of drug development, and similarly in the device industry. I mean, there have been well-publicized failures of devices, and one failure can offset a great many successes in that business, and so avoiding those failures is an important job.
So we're talking about saving thousands of lives.
Very much so. Millions.
Andrew McCulloch chairs the bioengineering department at the University of California, San Diego. He's a New Zealander in America. Professor Amanda Vincent is a Canadian based in Vancouver who does research in Sydney Harbour and Southeast Asia. She's the seahorse lady and has been on The Science Show many times talking about ways to save these delightful creatures from overwhelming exploitation.
Exploitation of seahorses continues to be excessive, but we now have new tools in place on a global scale that are probably going to make it possible to do something very useful on their behalf. So about 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, we put in place the first global trade regulations so that now 169 countries can only trade seahorses if such trade does not damage wild populations. And that gives us a whole new tool to play with. What's fun about it is this was the first time this had ever been done for any marine fishes of commercial importance. And Australia played a role in it, so that's rather nice.
Oh, really? What did Australia do?
Well, Australia made the first suggestion that maybe seahorses ought to be brought under international trade regulation way back in the late 1990s and then contribute to the overall development of this trade regulation measure of the subsequent years.
Well, of course, you've studied seahorses in Australia, but do you still study them off the coast of Canada?
Well, the seahorses are not found really on the west coast of Canada. We do have some on the east coast, but I must say we've never really studied them in Canada because it's the end of their range. So we tend to work on them everywhere else in the world. Australia has about a quarter to a third of the world's seahorse species and their relatives, the pipefishes and pipe horses and sea dragons. So we tend still to care a lot about what happens down in Australia. It's a little quirky, I suppose, to have a Canadian group leading the world on seahorses and their relatives, but we seem to be doing an adequate job of it.
Where is the biggest problem? Which parts of the world really are being almost intractable in this regard?
Well, the demand for seahorses is certainly growing in countries that have a high dependency on traditional Chinese medicine. So that would be in Greater China, Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan. But there's also a very big trade in aquarium fishes for the live display. And that would be Europe or North America consuming most of them. What's interesting is I think since we last talked, we've actually published a paper showing that Australia is the biggest exporter of the most valuable pipe horses in trade. Of all of the seahorse family, the pipe horses are considered the most special for medicine. And the only real source of those animals is Australia.
And what's being done about that?
Well, the Queensland Trawl Fishery actually put in place some regulations requiring that the fishers document their catches of these pipe horses, and that was the first time this had actually been done for this particular fishery. So that was a useful data gathering exercise. Now we need to find out whether there's likely to be any problem as a consequence of that export. I mean, a big export in fisheries doesn't necessarily mean that you've got a conservation problem.
Now, Amanda Vincent, I've seen you in films actually in Southeast Asia going to Chinese medicine shops. Has there been any change in the view of Chinese medical people about the effectiveness of the various seahorses and the pipefish that you describe? Because presumably they've got to be fairly practical about these things. Either the medicine works or it doesn't.
Well, look, traditional Chinese medicine is trusted by a quarter of the world's population. It's been codified for 2,000 years. It's recognized by the World Health Organization as a valid form of health care. We're not about to cross-examine people as to why they choose medicinal products. It's more a case of making sure that any choice is sustainable. And that's as true for Chinese medicine as it is for any other form of consumption, be it wildlife or domestic products. So our business is really to form relationships with the traditional Chinese medicine organizations to try to adjust the consumption to sustainable levels. So, for example, now in the Philippines, one of the major sources of seahorses for the international trade, we've got now 28 no-fishing zones, marine protected areas, if you will, all of them locally managed. And this is starting to protect a useful segment of the seahorse populations in that country. At another scale, we've been working really quite carefully with the traditional Chinese medicine traders and merchants. This is a major market for seahorses. And the traditional Chinese medicine merchants, the people in the business, if you want, have been fantastic allies on trying to make sure that this trade is sustainable. So rather than enter into conflict with the users, we've had a great dynamic of making changes. And then at the international scale, jumping up a bit, we've actually put in place the first ever global trade regulations for marine fishes of commercial importance, and that's with the seahorses. So now 169 countries have to ensure that any exports are sustainable, that is, they don't damage wild populations. And to me, the exciting thing about that, quite apart from the significance for seahorses, is that we set in place a new international instrument for managing any export fisheries, which offers real potential, I think, for a lot of other marine species that are in decline.
Amanda Vincent is a professor at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver. Now, I noticed that Professor Richard Dawkins is to make a video-linked appearance at the Sydney Writers' Festival in late May. This has a greater significance than anyone might think. Here's Flacco.
After rereading Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, it has become clear to me that the text harbours a hidden message from the Creator himself. You see, I have uncovered the Dawkins Code. The evidence that this book is the Word of God is overwhelming. One need only peruse the dust jacket to reveal within the barcode the numbers 999, which is the number of the beast lying on its back. Oh, mere coincidence? I think not. Also, one will find that a simple rearrangement of the letters of the author and title reveal this sentence. A rich, hard dog is on the lead. Oh, can it get any clearer than this? The book itself is published by Bantam Press. Now, Bantam being an anagram of Batman, who of course was played by Adam West, an anagram of Adam West being a mad stew, and of course an anagram of anagram is a ragman, which was the state of Adam West's career after the series ended in the 60s. Oh, uncanny to say the least. For those who still doubt, try this at home. Grab your copy of The God Delusion and randomly hold any given page before a mirror, and you will find the text is riddled with reverse writing. I rest my case. But by far the most telling evidence is this. By rearranging certain words which are ingeniously spread throughout the entire book, hidden within otherwise innocent sentences, I found this clear message from God, and I quote, "Hi there, it's God here, and after reading Richard's book, I have found his argument so compelling that I have realized that the possibility of my existence is extraordinarily remote. In light of this revelation, I hereby declare that I, God, have become an atheist. And as this will be my last message to humanity, I therefore lay the weight of responsibility for mankind's well-being on Mr. Richard Dawkins himself. And while he may not quite be a god, he certainly does move in a mysterious way. Put it down to the lumbago. And so, may you all rest in the security that all your dreams, hopes, and beliefs are nothing more than the rumblings of a few strands of proteins assembled by no one for no higher purpose. Have a nice day. Amen.
Flacco comes from the planet Dan Brown. Next week we travel to a stellar explosion from 20 years ago. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher and Janita Palmer. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.